We,
Sonia
and Janooni, are a couple of pals studying science in undergrad. We are not professionals.
Though every episode is meticulously researched, mistakes do happen.
If you notice that anything...
And we mean anything!
...we state is inaccurate, please let us know.
Your comments, suggestions, and queries are important in furthering our personal and audience's understanding of science.
Thanks for being a part of this discussion.
We appreciate you.
We really do.
Bop, bop, beep-a-da-bop.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sonia.
And I'm Janooni.
And welcome back to another episode of Beaker Bros.
I literally forgot. Sorry. When we drink out of bros because we're beakers. Oh, no. Sorry to do that again. God. It's okay. It's okay. We're good. We're good.
That's so funny.
We're beakers. It just reminds me of the time I was calling my insurance company and I was telling them my postal code and it's like 7B7. They're like, B or V? I'm like, yeah, B as in, I was going to say V as in vagina. And I couldn't think of any other word. I was like, V as in, I'm like, Victoria. Oh my God.
That's so funny. Well, anyways, do you want to try saying it again?
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to do the whole thing again? So it's easier for you.
I'm not going to lie. I was going to keep that part.
Okay. Where we drink out of beakers because we're pros.
Anyways, Janooni, how are you doing? I'm sure after that intro, I can tell you're a little distraught.
I'm okay. My brain is confused. My mouth is confused. But this will be a great episode.
You know what? I like the confidence.
Thank you.
Yep. This is going to be a particularly interesting one because we are going to be talking about, drumroll, HPV and cervical cancer. And just, I guess, as a little bit of an introduction to what HPV is and cervical cancer, I'm just going to give a brief overview, then Janooni's going to take it away with more of the info. But anyways, so in 1976, a dude named Dr. Harold Housen discovered that patients that were infected with the human papillomavirus, or HPV for short, are at a higher risk of developing cervical cancer. And discoveries that happened later on actually ended up paving the way for developing cervical cancer screening tests and vaccines that identify and prevent cervical tumors. And despite significant advancements, disparities infecting socioeconomic status, access to care and healthcare in general, and education continue to perpetuate incidences of HPV infection and cervical cancer, not just here in Canada, but worldwide. So in acknowledgement of the disparities that are severely faced by those in particularly low-income countries, or LICs for short, we just want to keep it simple, compared to high-income countries, or HICs for short, our podcast today will discuss the etiology of HPV infection and cervical cancer. So basically, its origins and how it manifests. And then we're also going to chat a little bit about the challenges of implementing identification and prevention strategies, as well as monitoring morbidity and mortality. So like death, I guess, caused by HPV and cervical cancer in low-income countries.
Yeah, so basically with this episode, it's kind of a shout out to all our cisgender females and our transgender men.
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, it's not something that just happens to cisgendered women. Yeah. That's something that's often overlooked. But anyways, Janooni, do you want to talk about the etiology? Yeah.
So the HPV is a non-envelope double-stranded DNA virus primarily transmitted through sexual contact. So once HPV infects its host, precancerous properties can develop, causing cervical cancer or cervical tumors. So in 90% of infected individuals, HPV infections are asymptomatic and can resolve within 12 to 24 months.
Can you talk about, real quick, what's asymptomatic just for our audience?
No symptoms.
There we go. Cool.
Like, you know, your asymptomatic COVID, asymptomatic HPV.
Very cool.
Anyway, so in patients actually with severe infections, this can develop into cervical cancer that we know. Approximately 99.7%. I love how I said approximately. Like,
like it could be 99.7452 whatever.
But 99.7% of all cervical cancer cases originate from HPV. So there's approximately 177 HPV subtypes, but HPV 16 and 18 cause approximately 70% of the cases.
Interesting. Oh, sorry, I just said interesting.
Interesting. So HPV infections typically take 10 to 20 years to manifest into tumors. But this long manifestation period provides ample time to screen and provide treatment using surgery and radiotherapy. Using modern technology, cervical cancer diagnoses are no longer a death sentence, which is a good thing. So a win for us.
Go science.
In fact, patients treated for precancerous lesions shortly after early screening have nearly 100% survival rate 5 years post-treatment.
That's why it's important. important to get your pap smears and stuff like that, which we'll be talking a little bit later on.
Yes. And so
real quick, sorry, why'd you just go like, oh, like halfway through?
Huh?
Oh, it sounded like you, oh, were you just inhaling at that point then? Maybe you were. But it sounded like for a second you had like an epiphany about something.
I might have.
But like the moment's gone. So
it's gone. I don't even know what it means. I was gonna say. The advent of HPV vaccination also represents a monumental moment in cervical cancer prevention history. So
there's to Dr. Harold Housen.
Housen.
And the dude in 2003, I think it was, that made the first vaccine, or sometime in like early 2000s. I think I know Dr. Harold Housen, he won a Nobel Prize for his discovery.
Yeah.
I don't know if the vaccine dude did, because it was based off of like a lot of the research from like previous people, but anyways, that's an aside.
Okay. That's pretty cool though.
Yeah.
There's different vaccines though. There's like a bivalent, a quadrivalent, and a non-valent vaccines. And these are licensed in over 100 countries and are nearly 100% effective in preventing cervical cancers caused by HPV. That is interesting.
Yeah, because like it's not necessarily like there's no such thing necessarily as like a vaccine that prevents cancer, but by preventing HPV, you are pretty much preventing that cancer from manifesting. So this is kind of like an anti-cancer vaccine.
It's like indirectly, yeah. It's
yeah.
Pretty cool. I love science. I love science.
Heck yeah.
Excited. So there's a two-dose series that can be administered 6 to 12 months apart, which is recommended for those younger than 15 years of age. But there's also a three-dose series administered 2 and 6 months respectively after their previous dose is recommended for those above 15 years of age. I don't know if you remember this, but when I was in grade 8, so what, like 13 or 14, we got the Kapow twice, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember I got it done at my school.
So ours was a two-dose one because we were under the age of 15. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A nice little reflection into our lives.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's a little fun fact about the vaccines, what HPV is, and all the fun science stuff that has brought us to where we are today and has allowed us to talk to you guys about all this fun stuff.
Very cool, Janooni. Thank you for sharing that. And anyways, I guess now to talk about like how HPV and cervical cancer have been addressed, firstly in high-income countries. So arguably, no country has been more successful in reducing incidences of HPV infection and cervical cancer than Australia, actually. So obviously there have been like other countries that have made a lot of headway, but one of the most prominent examples worldwide is considered to be Australia.
The kangaroos.
The kangaroos and the koalas, yeah, and the shrimp on the Barbie. Haha. Anyways, so since 2007, the Australian government has instituted free vaccines for HPV through school-based programs and provides access to cervical cancer screenings at little to no cost, which is awesome. And this these screenings begin every 5 years beginning at age 25. But this is just for like the program that's in Australia. It's not like necessarily representative of different healthcare policy. Like I know in Canada, we have like a different implementation strategy compared to other countries. But anyways, just continuing on. In Australia as well, there's also a national cervical cancer registry that monitors morbidity, mortality, prevention, and treatment outcomes. That was also introduced near the end of like the 2000s or like 2010 era. And through implementing these resources, incidences of HPV infection and cervical cancer in Australia has actually declined from 18 per 100,000 in 1991 to just 6 per 100,000 in 2014.
Wow.
So, and by 2028, Australia is actually expected to reduce incidences of HPV and cervical cancer to below 4 per 100,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And according to World Health Organization standards, this would mean that cervical cancer would effectively be declared eliminated from a population for the first time in history.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, because of all these cool things.
That's really awesome. Like what, 7 more years then?
7 more years is expected. Maybe earlier, maybe a little later. We'll see how progress continues to go. Yeah. But yeah, that this information is based from a Nature publication that was from 2020. So perhaps it's changed a little bit over the past few months since when the, or like more than a few months actually, since this article was published. But from when this article was published, that's what their projections are. But yeah, anyways, so Australia and other HICs or high-income countries are undoubtedly on course to achieving the World Health Organization cervical cancer elimination benchmark. However, it would be rather ignorant, or we would be rather remiss, I guess, to ignore the monumental disparities affecting healthcare services in underserved, uninsured, and underrepresented communities, not just in Australia, but globally. But again, since we're talking about Australia right now, critics argue that pre-existing healthcare infrastructure provides a really broad diagnosis and therapy options in the country, but the opportunity to receive these treatments are not proportionally distributed throughout its population. So if we want to like reference back to one of the episodes that we did about healthcare disparities, if you want more information on like what that is, you can check that episode out. But just like as a brief overview for like this context, this disproportionately can be seen using a study by Johnson and colleagues modeling system. So through initially analyzing HPV transmission and vaccine coverage in England, a widening disparity gap in cervical cancer incidences between white and ethnic minorities has been observed in many high-income countries like Australia. And for this reason, incidences of cervical cancer morbidity and mortality in Australia are nearly triple amongst Aboriginal women and women of color. So, and yeah, that's like, that's a huge disparity between, you know, like we're looking at these incidences or projections saying that like it's going to be eliminated by, you know, such and such year. But that does not negate the fact that women of color and Aboriginal or Indigenous descent are not being taken care of in the same way as their like white counterparts.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyways, just to wrap this up though. Additionally, there's also countries like the United States with privatized healthcare systems, which, yeah, that's another conversation for another time. But these systems restrict low-income individuals from accessing HPV screening tests and vaccines. And the added cost of these services coupled with improper efficacy, the added cost of these services coupled with improper efficacy education has also exacerbated HPV vaccine hesitancy and incidences of cervical cancer, again, not just in the United States or Canada, but worldwide.
Damn. Yeah, I was just going to, like, add to it, like, the whole, like, how improper, like, education or whatever has exacerbated, like, HPV vaccine hesitancy. It's, like, that with, like, most vaccines and stuff. at least like with the current state of vaccines, especially with the COVID vaccine. I was going to say like not being well educated, or if there was a cost associated with it that causes the disparity.
Sorry, I was just going to say like all this stuff by not providing access, it just decreases people's trust in healthcare providers and all that kind of stuff. So it just makes health worse overall for the country and worldwide.
It does. So Sonia was talking about like high income countries, HIC. I'm going to go into the low income countries. So the LICs. So these circumstances, what Sonia mentioned, was actually pretty similar to those that we see in the low-income countries. However, rather than impacting segments of the country's population, HPV and cervical cancer prevention is often a national crisis. So it's even worse.
Goddamn.
The WHO estimates.
So stupid.
The
WHO.
The World Health Organization estimates that 570,000 annually reported cervical cancer cases, so nearly 88% of the diagnosis and deaths, occur in low and mid-income countries.
Damn. Whoa.
Yep. 88%. And this is largely because of the inadequate access to HPV screenings and vaccines, funding, and education. So in Latin America, the Caribbean, sub-Saharan Africa, and Southeast Asia, less than 5% of women have been screened for cervical cancer in the past 5 years.
Holy crap. Less
than 5%.
Holy crap.
But, and like, that explains the 88%. So, in instances where screenings are available but left unused, distrust in the government is often an attributing factor. So, similar to the sentiments during the previous tetanus immunization campaigns, HPV screenings and vaccinations can be misunderstood as a way to control women and their fertility, which is, you know, it's a fair.
Oppressive.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm laughing, but it's bad.
It's not funny.
It's not. Additionally, aside from the lacking access to funding, health infrastructure, and trained healthcare workers who can administer screenings, social customs often place women in situations that encourage HPV transmission.
Sorry if I could just interrupt real quick. Like, imagine feeling so degraded by like systems that are supposed to help you that you would rather like jeopardize your care just because of like, or not just because, but rather because you felt or have been so heavily oppressed by that system. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense that like they, because of the way they're feeling,
and have been treated.
Yes.
Finish your thought.
No, go for it. Go for it.
No, it's your thought.
I feel like you have a better way of putting this because I'm like struggling to put this in words.
I'm so
like,
sorry.
I get it because I'm just like, okay, it makes sense for them to be like, yeah, why would I trust the government that has treated me and oppressed me in this way?
Yeah.
And they're choosing to like such a life-saving screening and these tests that they could do, they're choosing not to do because of all of this. And it's, you know, it's valid.
Yeah. Like their fears and concerns are valid. It's not based on, you know, something that they made up in their head. It's based on historical precedents.
Yeah.
It's an injustice.
It is. It really is. But so with the effects of these disparities on cervical cancer morbidity and mortality are low in high income countries. However, child marriage, polygamy, and disparity significantly influence cervical cancer incidences in low income countries like Malawi. Here, cervical cancer morbidity stands at 75.9 per 100,000 and mortality at 49.8 per 100,000. So, that's a whole lot.
Yeah. So just going back to how we were saying before that in Australia, it's expected to be 4 per 100,000. Yeah. This is like close to 20 times.
Yeah.
Higher.
That's like, a whole lot.
That's a lot of people dying unnecessarily.
Yeah. And just because they're in a low-income country.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess just to add on to this conversation about it, Like, despite the fact of having nearly 100% efficacy, the unaffordability of vaccines severely limits the ability for them to be used in these areas. So we can ramble about the fact that, like, you know, if they just had access to these vaccines or screening tests, like, there wouldn't be, like, it wouldn't be that high. But
yeah,
the fact of the matter is, it's just so unaffordable for these countries. And particularly, though, in nations that are, like, riddled with poverty, civil war, famine, simply paying, well, not to say simply, but for to pay more than $100 per dose of the vaccine is literally impossible.
And like, even here, like, if someone said you had to pay $100 for a vaccine, not everyone's going to be, like, okay with that.
Yeah, like, imagine charging for the COVID vaccine.
Damn.
Like, people wouldn't have, I mean, like, obviously the incentive to get it would be the fact that, like, you would be, like, you would have immunity against the COVID virus. Yeah. But, like, I guess, like that's what poverty does to you. You can't,
like, you can't afford it. At that point, it's like, you want food on the table, or do you want to, like, a potential thing, something? It's not even a definite, like, you'll get it kind of thing for them in their head. Mm-hmm. Like, do you want to spend $100 on something you could potentially get?
Yeah.
Or rather have food on the table, so.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's totally true. And for HPV vaccines to become widely available, a lot of low-income countries with a gross domestic product of less than $1,000 per capita have to be able to purchase and distribute these vaccines for less than $2 a dose. So 50 times less, not just to purchase the vaccine, but distribute it.
Oh my God.
Because, yeah, like, imagine, like, I don't know much about the logistics of distributing COVID-19 vaccines or, like, any vaccine in general, but I'm sure, like, the cost of that must be substantial.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, yeah, that's what a lot of NGOs and not just NGOs, but governments predict about what the cost needs to be. But in addition to, like, logistical barriers in funding and implementing nationwide screening and vaccine programs, excuse me, I just burped. But in addition to that, educating communities to regularly utilize these resources poses a lot of, like, significant hurdles. One notable case study, I guess, going back to Malawi, like Janouni mentioned before, is Malawi's first attempt to introduce a sort of comprehensive nationwide screening program. So in a 2015 study, researchers initially hoped to target about 80% of its eligible population to, like, give the vaccine. However, they were only successful in, or not just the vaccine, but, like, screenings more specifically. Mm-hmm. But however, they were only successful in screening about 30% of the population. And there was even a lesser amount of success was achieved in following up with these, or rather following up with those who tested positive for HPV infection. And Colombia, being another example, also encountered similar outcomes with their most recent prevention program, because in addition to poor screening and follow-up outcomes, women reported being hesitant and uncomfortable to receive vaccinations and cervical screenings. Uh-huh. So, yeah, collectively, these studies show that simply offering regular screenings and vaccines is not enough, clearly. You just sneezed, what? Dab. Sorry. Going back on topic, it's implementing innovative outreach and education strategies, particularly in low-income countries, is absolutely necessary. But some nations have already started doing this, though, which is pretty good. So, for example, in impoverished regions of Thailand, where the threat of cervical cancer is really amplified by the fact that, like, there's no one in isolated regions, healthcare workers are actually sent to these remote communities to offer screenings through mobile centers. So radios, megaphones, and church calls are also used to encourage hard-to-reach women to attend these screenings, like, literally just yelling, saying, like, we got cervical cancer screening programs.
They're going to say, we have cervical cancer. I was like, why would they yell that? Okay, yeah, the screenings. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And in areas of East Africa as well, where cervical examination facilities and women, or rather female healthcare workers are limited, self-sampling, which is the process in which a woman would swab their own cervical tissue for HPV, has also encouraged women to be screened and reduce personal discomfort, which is awesome. You're literally giving like people the autonomy to like control their health, which is phenomenal. But though these strategies are like really effective, or have been shown to be really effective, enlisting the support from respected leaders, so like just community leaders and religious leaders in general, is absolutely essential to fostering trust, as well as educating these communities about the origins of cervical cancer and the efficacy of like vaccination programs and screenings.
That was a whole lot of information. I was just gonna say, my favorite part was the ability for women to do their own screenings.
That's so empowering. Like,
yeah,
if I could just add on to that, like, not even the fact that, like, if you want to talk about, for example, trauma-informed care, like, you're giving women, like, if someone might have had like an unfortunate experience with trigger warning sexual assault, or just anything like that from their partner or anyone else in their life, like, you're giving women the ability to control like the whole screening process. I mean, like, at the end of the day, like, if there is like, the patient does have control in the screening process, but you're literally saying like, hey, like, we don't need to necessarily be involved with like touching or anything like that, like, here are the tools, here's how you do it, you can do it, and if you feel comfortable, you can send us your sample, and then, you know, you can get your results.
In like certain cultures, like, that's just a sort of way for them to feel dignified and not feel uncomfortable.
That's what healthcare is, giving people health and comfort and the ability to live their best life.
I love that. Like, here in Canada, when we get pap smears, like, you have to go get them done with an individual. From my knowledge, I don't think we have that option.
I mean, I'm sure.
I think you could.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm so happy.
Yeah. But you know what's another thing we didn't necessarily address? Sorry, I don't want to change gears unless you haven't finished your comment. But another thing, so we talked at the beginning, we spoke a little bit about it, but we talked a lot about like cisgendered women here, but another interesting disparity, I guess, that's really been overlooked is the LGBT community with incidences of HPV and cervical cancer, and more particularly trans men. So there was a study actually done in 2015. It's called the United States, or the U.S. Transgender Survey, so the USTS. It found that 71, so just to give like a little bit of context to it, it found that 71% of transgendered men have received an androgen therapy, so, and 14% had a hysterectomy. So it's just saying that like this many people had like gender affirming surgery. And this isn't like, and similar outcomes have been seen in like other high income countries. However, it's basically saying like, despite like this many people have had gender affirming surgery, there's also the amount of people that haven't had the gender affirming surgery, meaning like they still have their like female reproductive organs and they still have a cervix. And because a lot of the times when you transition, I can't speak for everyone because like obviously I'm not a transgendered man, but based on like the study, it was saying that like a lot of time when people transition towards being a transgendered man, they forget like certain, or they neglect rather, certain aspects of their female identity. And from this though, by neglecting like certain aspects of maintaining like your health from things that you haven't necessarily fully transitioned away from, you could like increase your chance of having cervical cancer. So it was saying that what's this over here? Sorry, I'm just looking at the stats. But yeah, it's just saying that like 27% of transgender men who still had their cervix had a pap test in the last in the last year, which is compared to 43% of adult cisgendered females in the United States. So literally like double the amount or half the amount of transgendered men who still have their cervix are not being screened for or are being screened for the whatever cervical cancer in comparison to like cisgendered female populations.
Are you saying that's more like of like a choice, not like really a choice, but they're like on their part, or they're like not able to access these screenings?
Yeah, this from what the study said, it didn't necessarily dive into too much about that, but it from like a thing, they also included a thing about like systemic and specific barriers that transgender men face when receiving cervical screening tests. Yeah. And there's like a multitude of factors. So it's a lack of education provided. It's a lack of resources. It's a lack of comfort that they feel around healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a multitude of factors that limit them or the amount of transgendered men who have had cervical cancer screening tests.
Yeah.
And yeah, there is a high or a higher proportion of transgendered men in comparison to cisgendered females who have cervical cancer.
Ooh, that's not good.
Yeah. But yeah, the sad thing is though, literally like half a century or more than half a century of groundbreaking discoveries has literally provided all of humanity the tools needed to eliminate HPV infection and cervical cancer. And but the thing is like the now the challenge lies in distributing these resources fairly and equitably, not just to like high income countries, but low income countries and everyone in between.
It's like the science is there. The science has given us the answers, but now we have to find the answers for these social disparities and all that stuff.
Yeah. And that isn't possible without the support from governments and non-governmental organizations, healthcare workers, community members, families, like
everyone,
everybody.
Yeah. We all play a part. Like, I know we said this episode is for, like, cisgender female and transgender male. But, you know, everyone, like, this is a podcast that everyone should listen to and, like, educate yourself and support those around you.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, HPV and cervical cancer is one of those things where it is preventable. At this point, like, people don't need to die anymore from these diseases. Because, like, there are tools that are nearly 100% effective.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just making sure that healthcare or doing our best to make sure healthcare is equitable and freely distributed around the world.
Yeah. I was going to add like for pap smears and stuff, like it might not be well known. Like at least for me, I wasn't quite familiar with like, when do I get one? How do I like whatever and stuff. So I was doing some research and what I came across was essentially you should start getting a pap smear by the age of 21. And from the ages of 21 to 29, you should be getting a pap smear every 3 years. Once you're over the age of 30 and you haven't had any abnormal pap smears, then you can have a pap smear. You should get a pap smear every 5 years. And you should be getting tested until like the age of 65 or so.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm just reading the Government of Ontario's website about like cervical cancer testing and prevention. We'll also include this link in the description, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you for sharing that, Janine.
Yeah. Pap smears are also covered by OHIP. So to our pals in Ontario, go get them done. It's fun. We can all go together.
All at once.
All at once. We'll make it a nice little trip post-COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still get it done during COVID, by the way. So, yeah.
Anyways, but unless Janine, you have any more that you want to contribute?
No, that is all. So, everyone, do your part. Get a pap test. If you can get a pap test,
can you
stay healthy, friends?
Yeah. Alrighty. Thanks for sharing that. Thank you, everyone, for watching. That wraps up this week's episode.
Goodbye.
Bye.